It is Tuesday, October 8th, 2013, and this is episode 37 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. I am joined, as usual, tonight by Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, everyone.
As usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and don't represent those of our employers. So, I want to start off by saying I apologize for the delayed release of this podcast. I have been really busy. One of the things I did over the past couple of weeks was attend DerbyCon, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that at the end of the podcast. And just in general, I think it was a great time. Anyhow, so we'll start with stories. First up, this is just a very brief thing. The author of the Black Hole and Cool Exploit Kits was recently arrested, allegedly, in Russia. And, you know, I, being who I am and reading what I know or reading what I do, Black Hole to me seemed like kind of the preeminent exploit kit. Well, apparently that was true as of the end of last year, but times, they have changed. And so I was thinking, I wonder what's going to happen to, you know, exploit kits and watering hole attacks. Well, Naked Security actually answered my question kind of at the same time I had it. And the answer is it's not going to have any impact.
Helpful.
Yes. So unbeknownst to me, apparently there's been quite a lot of tectonic shifts in exploit kit market share, if you will. And, you know, looking at the graphs that Sophos put up, even between August and October, there's major shifts. So, for instance, as of August, Black Hole and Cool accounted for about 4% of market share. And in October, that was down to 2%. Whereas some others like Neutrino and Sibhost are in the 30-40% range.
You know, what I found interesting about this is, you know, the authors put out there that the infrastructure around a kit is really important these days, which is fascinating sort of, you know, shift from back in the day when someone released some sort of kit out in the wild and people just grabbed it and did with it what they will. Nowadays, you know, it's a service. It's malware as a service, right? And so this infrastructure being out there matters. So it kind of, you know, is almost adding a weakness to these malware authors if they are so reliant on these infrastructures for widespread use of this malware code. It actually matters now if you start taking these things down, as opposed to before, hey, you wrote it and released it out into the wild. It doesn't matter if you took the author out. You know, people are going to grab it and run with it anyway. Nowadays, it seems like that's not the case. They really do seem to care about, you know, what sort of infrastructure and you know, ecosystem that's built up around these malware kits. So it's interesting. It's an interesting change in that malware world. And I'm sure it's been out there for a while, but these guys kind of really did a good job of pointing that out.
Yeah, it's an interesting world how this has turned into a really substantial business. And there's a lot of, apparently a lot of money being made in the subscriptions to these tools. And, you know, I have to wonder if a lot of the erosion of Black Hole's market share, if you will, was when their source code got released.
I think you're just jealous because your exploit kit has got zero market share, and you know you're just jealous, aren't you?
Well, you're right. It doesn't even show up on the list.
You're not even, you know, if like Gardner were to make a magic quadrant, you're not even in the loser square. You're nowhere.
Dang.
Sorry.
All right. Well, I can't argue with it. With
I don't think Gardner calls it the loser square, by the way. I think that's my verbiage, just for the record.
All right. Well, moving on.
Gardner's going to sue me now, aren't they?
Yeah, that's why I'm trying to move on.
Get in line.
We're down from 4 to 3 listeners now.
And 2 of them are your parents.
That's true. That's true. My mom listens twice. All right.
There's a lot of your mom jokes, and I'm just going to let them go.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Moving on.
The next two stories are somewhat related, and they cover hardware-related attacks. And these are a little dated now. The first one is some proof-of-concept malware in graphics cards. And actually, the story specifically is about detecting hardware-based malware on systems. And, you know, I think the important thing here is to recognize that there is another kind of growing vector out there that we have to start paying attention to, you know. So we've all thought about how do we keep our people away from USB drives they find in the parking lot, right? But what about hardware components? And there are no real effective detection techniques against this. Fortunately, there isn't a lot of malware that we're aware of yet, but I think this points out that there's probably a big growth area to come. And maybe it's only in what we'll call the advanced segment of the malware producing organizations.
Yeah, it's, you know, it makes sense, right? You've got a piece of hardware in there that you can read and write to memory with that has its own processor, its own memory space, and has the ability to do things. So to me, what this tells me, and this is interesting, look, I detected it. Yeah, okay. But you detected it with endpoint software. If the host is already popped, I can't trust any sort of this is what drives me crazy. If the host is already popped, how can I trust any of the detection software?
Exactly.
Right? How can I trust anything on that box, right? So what this leads me back to is, okay, fine. So we've got another avenue of the system to be exploited. Why don't we just consider this another piece of software, right? It's another application that could be attacked. Fine. This leads me back to we need better network detection techniques. Because at the end of the day, if I can't trust the endpoint, hopefully I can trust at least, you know, the span port or the tap or whatever it is I've got it set up that, you know, is feeding into my monitoring and, you know, instrumentation that's watching this stuff. So at the end of the day, I don't really care, you know, if I'm going to get simplistic about this, I don't really care if the malware is sitting in graphic card memory or main memory or, you know, wherever it may be. At the end of the day, you know, I need to be able to pick up what it's doing somewhere. And the place I can trust usually is the network.
Right. And so basically what you're talking about is looking for the evidence, you know, what are the symptoms? What does the malware do?
Yeah. And that's, you know, supposition put forth that this is some sort of malware that is indeed having some sort of network component, right? Which most interesting malware today has, whether it's going back to a CNC server, whether it's trying to exfiltrate data, whether it's, you know, at the end of the day. And it's tough, right? You know, okay, let's say this thing is just looking like a regular HTTP session and it's going out to port 80 and it's doing a post up to a website. You know, how are you going to detect that? Anyway, you can run around in circles, but at the end of the day, this is interesting from a standpoint of, hey, you can throw malware onto graphic cards. That's pretty cool. But from a defender standpoint, I don't know that it changes the equation dramatically. Other than, hey, our attack surface just got a little bigger. Yay.
Exactly.
Right. But it's interesting. And it's something to be aware of. But, you know, along these lines, just completely, you know, kind of sidestepping just a second, because they're talking about, you know, endpoint antivirus and anti-malware detection. Did you see that Microsoft came out and said, you know, Microsoft Security Essentials is a baseline and we expect third parties to be better than us?
I did.
And did you see the article who was quoted?
It escapes me. I remember it being a recognizable name. Holly Stewart.
Holly Stewart,
yes.
Yeah. Of and I believe it is the same Holly Stewart we knew from the ISS days, so I thought that was kind of a cool thing.
That's great. I'm glad she landed somewhere good.
Yeah, but anyway, you know, believe it or not, I actually like Microsoft Security Essentials because it's quiet, it's lightweight, it's not bloated, and it, you know, is effective against the, you know, bottom 10 percentile, but it's interesting for Microsoft. And I think that that whole thing was a little spun against them where they said, hey, we do, you know, this is a minimum level of protection. Well, of course, you know, we do expect third parties to do a better job. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting side note on the whole endpoint malware detection world.
Yeah, you know, on that point, one thing I was wondering, actually two things. One was, it was interesting that they were kind of couching it now as appropriate for the technical elite, so to speak. You know, I guess the people that, you know, knowingly go to porn sites, I don't know. You know, the other,
come on now, that's not fair.
I know, I know.
There's lots of advertising, you know, right. That's on legitimate sites that, you know, and leave, you know, what's wrong with going to porn sites? That's all.
I'm being stereotypical.
I'm going to porn sites as a record. What are you talking about?
Being unfair. He's browsing porn right now as we talk.
It's true. There's more your mom jokes here. I'm going to leave them alone.
So the other thing to me that telegraphed was probably a declining investment in R&D.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a shame.
Yeah.
You know, cuz it's kind of an easy set it and forget it, you know, for, you know, the less technically savvy out there, that, you know, just the home users that just need something, right? And I can't tell you the number of times I've helped friends who, you know, their box came loaded with Symantec that expired 3 years ago and it's not working. And, you know, I can at least put on MSE and just, you know, say, let it do its thing. And there's something at least, right?
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Well, you know, I guess the last thing on the video card deal was, again, the whole article was about this researcher coming up with a way to detect malware, and, you know, yay. But by the way, the malware was apparently written by him too.
So
you know,
yeah,
put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, not exactly the most, you know, double blind taste test kind of proof, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting technique, right? He's looking at what memory's doing. He's looking at what, you know, he's kind of, in essence, he's looking for, he whitelisted what the box should be doing.
Right.
And then he's scanning for anomalies that, you know, were something else. That makes sense, right? But as we often see, although I'm a fan of whitelisting solutions, that has some, let's just say, scalability challenges at times. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't want to be sort of cynical, because I think it's interesting research, but it definitely was not, hey, we found this in the wild, you know.
Right.
This wasn't, you know, it's, hey, this could happen kind of thing. Well, that's good to know, you know. That's, I appreciate that, but it's not, oh my god, rip out all your graphics cards, you know, kind of day.
And speaking of not found in the wild, the next story is about some researchers who they made two attacks on chips. And they did this by altering the polarity of the doping agent.
When you say chips, do you mean like Ponch and Joan?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Man, you're making me feel old.
All four of our listeners just went, huh? Google it. Hey, you.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll really like that. So anyway, it's probably not well known, but kind of very subtly over the past couple of years, the world of CPUs has gone from a pseudo random number generator to an actual random number generator. And so those random number generators have become increasingly important in especially cryptography and generating strong keys and things like that. So what these researchers did was attack an Ivy Bridge Intel chip. In the manufacturing process, they applied just basically very slightly altered the doping over a couple of hundred transistors. And that was enough to effectively reduce the entropy produced by the random number generator from 128 bits to 32 bits. And the best part is, you can't actually tell that this was done.
Yeah. cool. You know, but that's like saying, hey, if a bad guy added bad code to a chip, bad things could happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we know. Okay. So how are you going to actually pull off this attack, right? Okay, first of all, so I drop your entropy down to 32 bits. Great. So that means I can better predict what, you know, pseudo-random numbers you're going to generate or random numbers you're going to generate. So then I can start figuring out how you're utilizing that and, you know, potentially break your encryption. Okay. That's a very sort of esoteric, long, long con we're pulling there, you know. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you've really only got two points where you can do this. You can do this during design, right? Or you can do it during fab.
Right.
So how realistic is this actually going to happen? As opposed to, more likely, Chinese firms or whomever, or perhaps even, you know, U.S. firms under direction of the NSA, building in purposeful built, you know, for lack of a better term, backdoors into their chips.
Yeah.
You know, I get it, and I get that it's difficult to detect, but it comes back down to, okay, what else could you do?
Right. Well, that's a good point. I think the problem here is, we mentioned this, I think, last time, right? Back a couple years ago, maybe 10 years ago, in fact, we were hypothesizing about some advanced malware, and I think that's probably where we're at with hardware now. You know, this is very speculative, and you know, I have to personally wonder, what will we find was happening now or maybe in the next couple of years when we get 10 or 15 years down the line? I really think we're going to find some unfortunate things, and maybe it's of the form like this, where it's very subtle and difficult to tell, which was the whole point of this particular article. And by the way, you know, reading the actual paper was really interesting. You learn a lot about chip design that, you know, I never really knew. But you're right. You know, if you're an advanced adversary, let's say, and, you know, you have influence over the company that's making the chips or designing the chips or what have you, you know, the sky's the limit. You can do whatever you want anyway.
So here's a question. You know, I mentioned earlier about generating good random numbers, and this is not something I know a ton about. Are you familiar with how they're actually generating good random numbers these days off of CPU instructions, or how they're moving beyond? Because you mentioned earlier, it's no longer pseudo random number generation. I didn't know that you could do true random number generation off of a piece of hardware.
I won't claim to fully understand it, but they are using, I believe, basically noise.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen gear that, you know, purposeful built gear that, you know, monitors like cosmic background radiation as a means to grab a seed for random number generation, right? And, you know, because at the end of the day, these random number generators really comes down to seeding them, right? Where you start your generation. And if you can really randomize that seed, then you're in good shape. And that's always been the challenge. I know I'm digressing into something that I'm dangerously weak in my knowledge of, but it is of interest. And I guess I should do some research. But
my favorite random number generator, by the way, was a webcam pointed at a lava lamp.
That's awesome. So all that being said, yeah, it is interesting that, you know, they could introduce very subtle problems into chips, or, you know, and it's very difficult to detect. And I, you know, it will be interesting to see down the line. I guess, you know, at the end of the day, what are you going to do? You know, at some point you have to trust something or you're not going to get work done. It's, you know, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. Do you have, if you go back to the philosophy of something will always infect your host, how do you deal with that?
Right. Right. All right. Well, enough of that happiness, and we'll move on to other happiness. So there's a couple of related stories, and I just want to start by saying, holy cow, is Brian Krebs the man or what?
Sure.
Yeah. So there's a there's a couple of related stories.
Jerry, do you have a man crush?
I do. There are not that many good journalists left in this world, and I would say he's among them.
All right. When does the restraining order expire?
Not allowed to know. So anyhow, the story starts out with Brian Krebs doing some investigative journalism related to basically a doxing site, right? A site that ID thieves can go to and buy some data. And this particular site was called ssndob.ms, as in social security number, date of birth, .ms. And you could buy basically dossiers on a very wide range of people. And apparently, earlier this year in the March time frame, people who follow the news probably remember Eugene Natsi doxing a whole bunch of real high-profile people like Michelle Obama and Robert Mueller and John Brennan and Jay-Z and a whole bunch of other people. Well, that kind of started the downward spiral. Some research tracked that back, and I think also there was a compromise of the SSNDOB site, and some people actually doxed them. And an analysis of that data led Krebs and a guy that he was working with led them to a command and control server. And long story short, in the ensuing investigation they performed, they found out that a number of hackers had placed some malware on servers belonging to LexisNexis, Dun & Bradstreet, and Kroll. And Kroll provides basically background checks for hiring purposes. And so apparently part of the service you got from the ssndob.ms site actually was pulling data off of those sites. So interesting. There was some interesting timing referenced in here. You know, for instance, ssndob.ms apparently has been up since early 2012, and apparently it's been pretty productive at producing information since then. However, LexisNexis and Dun & Bradstreet and Kroll apparently have only been compromised since early this year. So there's some unanswered questions in my mind, but you know, we may never really know. So there was some interesting repercussions to this. And in particular, LexisNexis, I assume everybody knows what that is, but some of the implications is that, you know, LexisNexis is a provider of the knowledge-based access platforms used by a lot of credit providers, right? So, you know, you want to apply for a credit card, or you want to pull your credit report from TRW or Equifax. They ask you questions, you know, what kind of car did you have as your first car? What street did you grow up on? Well, all that stuff is stored in LexisNexis. All that stuff is now available to a bunch of attackers.
That's huge, you know, and there's a lot of sort of things we don't know about this right now. And I'd be very curious to know how the initial avenue of attack proceeded, how this went undetected, and what data was actually exfiltrated. But this is kind of like the holy grail, right, for folks who are trying to do any sort of identity theft, getting this sort of information. I mean, the types of stuff that these companies hold is very, very, very valuable and very sensitive, you know. This is the kind of stuff that certain you know, European countries look at us like we're crazy for allowing companies to gather this information on us, and that we don't have laws banning this sort of thing. But, you know, from a defender standpoint, it makes it tough, right? If I can no longer trust that this, in theory, private knowledge of my users, right? Because there's actually, you know, various software out there that you can buy for commercial use. I think RSA actually makes some stuff where, you know, your help desk guys could have access to information like this when a user calls up to verify the user is who they say they are. Well, how do I trust that now? It can be pretty devastating, right? And then you wonder, you know, is this just straight up you know, regular old information mining for, you know, user account fraud, or is this more targeted? Is this the beginning of something like we saw with the RSA hack, where they were going after specific defense contractors, you know, or the Bit9 hack, you know, to go after specific companies? You know, not to get all, you know, Jason Bourne on you, but at the end of the day, sorry, that, you know, it's the hipper, newer version of James Bond, just so you know,
nice. Right.
You know, just to get you in touch with, you know, the younger hip kids out there today. But it is pretty devastating, and, you know, I would love to know why this hasn't gotten a bit more press. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it seems relegated to some of the tech press.
Because it's a big deal, you know, and unless the boxes that were popped were pretty minor, right? You know, and that's what we don't know. It's, they're kind of putting together that this stuff came from there, and but I'm hesitant to, you know, convict and pass judgment on these companies without knowing more details, right? And not that I have anything against Curbs, and I think he's doing a great job here, but at the end of the day, it's still a lot of sort of, we're not sure. But yeah, it's pretty scary. It is pretty scary, and it's, it goes back to, I'd love to know how these things got on there, because how do you know how to defend against what happened unless you know what the initial exploit phase was?
Right. Well, there are a couple of things that we do know from the investigation. There was a part two to this, actually part two and a part three. And I think there's a part four and a part five that haven't been released yet. So one interesting thing was LexisNexis came back and said, you know, we did find some malware on two web servers. And this was the same malware that was found on a number of other compromised systems that they do know was successful in exfiltrating some data. And at least in the context of the white collar computer crime, W3C or something like that, they had a system compromised, and that was confirmed to be through a cold fusion exploit, which, by the way, has been pretty popular this year with a whole bunch of pretty high profile exploits. So I do wonder if it's possible that that's a common thread. But LexisNexis did say that this particular piece of malware didn't have access to their data. And the other interesting thing was Krebs said that, you know, a week, I guess at least a week after this was disclosed to LexisNexis and allegedly the servers were cleaned, he was still able to order information off this server sourced through LexisNexis. And LexisNexis came back and said that information was being provided through a improperly used law student's login ID.
Yeah, and I seem to remember that this has happened before, where LexisNexis had some bad guys able to basically legitimately order information that they weren't vetting their customers, which seems like a much easier way to get this information, by the way. Just sign up as a customer, right? Then, and this could, you know, open up the whole can of worms of why they allowed to gather and sell this information without our consent, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll spare you that rant this evening, but we will revisit at another time. However, it is interesting that, you know, how are these guys not more aggressively out there defending their own brand? You know, if I were these guys, I would be doing everything I could to figure out, you know, I'd be placing honey records out there and looking for them to show up places and see if I could buy them. And I'd be doing a ton of stuff to see if any of my stuff was out there. You know, and it's a shame these guys aren't doing that. You know, create a user record and a bunch of information, makes it look very legitimate, but it's completely just a honey record for, you know, Joe Schmo, and then go see if I can buy a Joe Schmo record and see what happens and trace it back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So back to your earlier point about, you know, is this a sign of something bigger? This apparently was, you know, I don't know that we actually know the true story, but apparently this was a fairly significant operation that had 1,300 customers, including a number of customers who they considered to be high-volume users. High-volume users such that the SSN DOB site actually set up an API for these other companies to query against. And apparently, they were actually making more money as a basically a reseller, service reseller, to some other doxing / ID theft sites. You know, it does seem like a pretty well run criminal enterprise, and I would be more concerned with who their customers were and what were the customers doing with this. And the other second part of this was back to that white collar crimes, computer crimes unit, which was a joint task force with the FBI. That organization had been compromised, and I think for 11 weeks this group had access. And you know, while LexisNexis is bad, that group had access and enabled these guys to access a whole bunch of different databases from law enforcement and lots of other systems as well. That group, the White Collar Crimes Unit, apparently was often consulted to help trace flows of money. So they had access to a lot of information, and apparently a lot of that information was accessed by these guys.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, defense is hard, right? I don't want to throw these guys on the bus for getting breached. But at the same time, they clearly need to do a better job of detecting the breaches once they happen. And I think that's what, you know, all of us are, you know, need to keep in mind, is it's incredibly difficult to keep these guys out. And I keep thinking like we're focusing too much on keeping the bad guys out and not enough on assuming they're going to get in and then figuring out how we detect it. It's a fascinating article, and I would urge everyone to read it because there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And so that was one of the things I wanted to bring up is that, you know, you've got a couple of different very high profile companies whose core business is protecting the data that they have. Now, one could say, well, you know, they're kind of paid to release that data, but you know, that's their core business, and it's basically allowing their intellectual property to leave. And so one has to think that they're pretty well incented not to let that happen. And it did, and it happened to a bunch of very different organizations who probably have substantially different levels of capability to defend. And I think you're on the right point that we as an industry have been very focused on prevention, and we've got to start thinking about detection, because prevention just isn't working. You know, look at all these guys, right? I think the first three, LexisNexis, Dun & Bradstreet, and Kroll, they were in there for 5 months. On the other one, they were on there for 11 weeks. You know, that's a long time.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and who knows, right? You know, I don't want to be harsh on these companies, but we don't know their stance. We don't know the budget they have for security. But, you know, the end of the day, if they want to try to stop this, they've got to detect it quicker.
Yes.
And it's easy for us to say. It's hard to do in practice, but that is the reality. But this is pretty fascinating. I mean, it is a very sort of organized, methodical, you know, business that was started up around this. And what else is out there that hasn't been found is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it's a good segue, right? So while poking around on the server that these attackers were using, I guess Mr. Krebs found a 40 gigabyte file. And that file contained the source code of a whole bunch of Adobe products. And we don't yet know all what products, but we know that it contained at least ColdFusion, surprise, surprise, and Adobe Reader. So I suspect we're going to find out that there's a whole lot more, maybe everything. Don't know. 40 gigabytes of source is quite a lot of source. And then, you know, there's obvious questions about, well, if they had access to the repository, did they have access to push code? And in the story that we link here, the CSO of Adobe has indicated that they're doing some work to scrub their source check-ins and whatnot to see if anything might have been illicitly contributed.
Yeah, that's scary. look at it this way. Adobe's finally getting that source code audit they've always wanted.
Yes.
Oh, that was harsh. Sorry, Adobe. This kind of goes back to the same old thing we just don't know, right? How long has this been out there? How long has this been floating around out there, and who else has it? And if they can grab it, right, did they check something in?
Right.
That's crazy stuff. And it's now we're not even to a point of being able to look for bugs. We've got to look for things that are intentionally planted and in source code and such. And it's kind of the stuff that we always speculated, could be done 10 years ago, but wasn't ever really happening.
Right.
And now we're starting to see it really happen. And it's sucks for Adobe. I will tell you one thing. And this is sort of a poor man's way of doing things, but whenever something like Reader gets so ubiquitous and so attacked, it's not perfect, but I love switching to an alternative, like Foxit or something else. Just because I'm not saying those tools are perfect, but market share has a lot to do with what gets attacked. And if I'm not using Reader and 90% of the PDF-based malware is against Reader, doesn't work against other code, that could be helpful. But again, that's not a wide, that's not a scalable solution either, because as soon as everybody switches to something else, hey, look, new attack platform, right? It's the whole mythos around Mac being free of viruses. Well, that's because nobody wrote anything for Mac, right? Now that's changing. And we're seeing a lot of attacks against Mac because it has enough market share to matter. Adobe is they've done a good job of getting those out there, but now they're also a massive, huge target and frankly haven't done the best job of writing secure code. And it wouldn't surprise me if more of these sorts of companies are actually getting attacked in this way, the actual manufacturers of code, and the bad guys are going after their source code, to find all sorts of ways to make it easier for them to write the malware in 0 days. I don't think they've talked about it all. If they don't have any idea how this code even got out there, right? They haven't even traced it back yet from what I've seen.
No.
Yeah. It's scary. Yeah, I don't have a lot of sort of valuable things to add on this one other than it's interesting and scary, that this happened. I don't think they're going to be the last.
Well, so I've got a couple of thoughts on it. Number one is your point about, who else has this happened to? And that's a really difficult question to answer. And you have to consider that, it was kind of happenstance that we came to learn about this. It was Krebs doing this investigation that found this happening.
I'd be curious how old this code is, right? Like what version certain things are compared to what's current. Yeah. That might give them an idea of when it was exfiltrated out. If it's four versions ago, that gives them at least a time frame.
Right.
Not saying that makes it better or worse from a protection standpoint, because I doubt all this code's been rewritten since, whenever this happened.
So allow me to wildly speculate, because
okay.
I'm unfortunately often right.
Hey, it's your show, man.
So, sorry, ColdFusion has been a pretty popular platform. We know that at least one of these players has essentially admitted that it was ColdFusion that was exploited, the WC3 or W3C, whatever it was. And my expectation is that these guys were kind of a one-trick pony. They got a toolkit that allowed them to launch 0 days against, or at least know, what at the time would have been a 0 day against cold fusion sites. And I am extraordinarily suspicious that the same thing was probably being used against all these companies. And I don't know what the motivation would have been against Adobe, other than to say that there were really two aspects to this attack. Not only the source code, but also an attack against their cloud platform. So they had 2.9 million user IDs and encrypted passwords, whatever that means. I'm not sure how you encrypt a encrypt a credit card number so that it is still usable. I'm not sure how you do that. But in any event, 2.9 million accounts and encrypted credit card numbers.
Well, I'm guessing they must have been. It was encrypted at rest, right? It was sitting on the disk encrypted, but clearly when read, it's decrypted. So,
yep. Every case that I've seen like this, the key is recoverable. And, the source for the site or whatever, which is kind of sitting next to the database, has the key. And so I'm always very skeptical.
Man, if it's encrypted, we're safe, man. That's all that matters.
It's true.
That's what PCI told me to do. Just encrypt it, man.
What more do we need?
So take your silly logic and go encrypt something with it. Sorry.
So, I'm pretty skeptical that this was just not another cold fusion attack.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, sometimes we've seen this over and over again. Widespread malware is sometimes randomly put out there, and then the bad guys look and go, "Oh, look, wow, we're on some Adobe machines. What can we do with this?"
Exactly.
So you never know, right? This is the challenge of we don't know, makes it tough to talk about it coherently, but it's good that we know about it and are talking about it.
Yeah, but I think it highlights two things. Number one, if you're using something like Cold Fusion, pay attention and patch. I know these things are pretty pervasive. Earlier in the year, we saw a whole spate of very high profile targets being hacked in succession by Cold Fusion vulnerabilities. And the reason is, and I think this happens a lot more than anybody wants to admit, people stand up or organizations stand up a website and it's there for a long time and people forget about it. It becomes a little subcomponent or a subdomain or what have you of a main site, and it's just kind of out of sight, out of mind. People are really bad at that. I mean, I just see that happen over and over again.
Yeah, agreed. It goes back to the basic blocking tackling that's really tough, which is just know your assets, know what's out there, and, pay attention to them.
Right.
I see this all the time, and it's tough. And it's a matter of, and the larger an organization gets, the tougher this becomes to manage. And it's funny when I talk to companies about they're going to put something up, and there's a big argument over who's going to care about it and feed it and run it. And I think those are important questions to have, because if you ignore a box, if you're not taking care of it, very quickly does it erode into something that is exploitable. This is why you can't just throw technology at all these problems. Because even if you had, let's say, there's new IPSs out there and firewalls that do quote-unquote virtual patching, right? So they find out about a bug and they look for specific things attacking that bug and stop it, right? So it's like a signature written for that, it's architecture for, we're looking for certain attack vectors. So you don't have to patch right away. So you don't have downtime. Nonetheless, you still have to know that, I have Cold Fusion version XYZ and it is vulnerable to, attack ABC, and I've got to mitigate that in some way. And unless you've got the bandwidth, which means you're not running your InfoSec guys into the ground by having such an understaffed department to manage this stuff, you're almost asking to have these sorts of problems. And I'm not saying that, I'm not blaming the victim here. I'm saying that we've seen this over and over and over again, and you know, companies are just not paying enough attention to these assets when they deploy them.
Yeah. And you know, the point of this podcast is really, obviously, as you pointed out, we don't know for certain what happened, and pretending to know is wrong. But again, the point of this podcast is to help people think about ways to defend their environments. And so, you know, sometimes we have to go out on a limb a little bit and speculate about what might have happened and what might we do to avoid a similar fate. And so, you know, we could end up being wrong. We could find out in a month that it was, it was a USB drive in a parking lot. Who knows?
Well, it doesn't kill the advice of, regardless of how they got popped, why couldn't they detect it?
Exactly.
Right? What prevented them from seeing the traffic? Was this just incredibly stealthy? Were they not instrumented properly? Did they not have the right, you know, sort of procedures and policy in place, or technology in place, or people in place? Was it impossible to detect? That's sort of where I've spent a lot of my thinking lately is what can you do to understand as soon as possible that something's gotten, you know, popped, and find a way to detect it and shut it down quickly, minimize the damage.
That's got to be the name of the game now. I really think as an industry, we've got to really embrace that concept and figure out some effective mitigation strategies and detection strategies that are appropriate for our environment, because it's a losing proposition to keep everybody out. We need to get to the point where we can more effectively detect when things go awry.
And it's not easy. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's no magic bullet here, but so switching topics entirely. I heard you went to DerbyCon.
I did go to DerbyCon, and it was awesome.
I'm sorry I wasn't there, but why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
So, I have to tell you, this is embarrassing. I've been in the industry for a long time, and this is my first security conference. So, it was an enlightening thing for me. DerbyCon, I guess, in contrast to what I've been told about the Vegas conferences, is relatively small and homey, right? It's 2,000 people, 1,900 people, so not tens of thousands of people. Which was nice. But there were a lot of different sessions, and it was a little hard to choose, right? So they had 6 tracks running simultaneously. And, that was interesting at times, figuring out what to attend. But the thing that I did want to point out is that every single session is available on YouTube. You can watch every one of them.
That's awesome. Were most of the sessions about attacks? I mean, that's one thing I see at a lot of cons right now, is that it's all about sexy new attacks. What would you say the sessions were, you know, about exploits and attacks and versus defense?
So, good question. They actually broke up their tracks that way. They had a break me track, which was the historical, you know, penetration tester view. They had a fix me track, which was the defender view. They had a hybrid track. They had a teach me track. So like if you're kind of new getting into it, this kind of fundamental type thing. And then they had, some others that were kind of everything else. Most of what I did were either the break me or the fix me, because, you know, I think it helps to understand both to an extent. I won't say I was disappointed in the fix me. A lot of it was, oh boy, to an extent, a little bit defeatist, right? But I do think it's probably not unwarranted. Although I will tell you, there was some really, really fantastic talks. Andy Ellis gave a talk. I forget the title of the talk, but it was I think it was called Reprogramming the Human Operating System. And he, if you don't know, is the CSO of Akamai. And it was a phenomenal talk. I highly recommend you go and read it. Basically, it's looking at the behavioral reasons that people do what they do, in particular related to security, right? So, you know, as security people, we think about the stupid users, or, you know, why would somebody open that link? Why would somebody do that particular thing? And his point is that if you ask that question, you're probably not understanding the context of the world that person is living in. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, that's true. That's one reason why I think security awareness training is somewhat, I mean, it's helpful, but it's not a panacea, right? I mean, it's just not. Social engineering works for a reason.
And that was a pretty prominent and pronounced thing, right? You know, it's becoming really, really effective to attack endpoints, you know, and trick people into doing things, and as opposed to attacking infrastructure these days. So there was a talk on phishing, which I thought was really interesting, and it was put on by I forget the person's name, but he did some studies about the effectiveness of phishing campaigns, and obviously he was phishing for the purposes of preventing real phishing attacks in his organization, but he found that all phishing exercises aren't created equal. So, for instance, his research found that phishing attacks are more effective on Fridays than any other day
really?
Of the week.
And, interesting.
Yeah. And so his point was, you know, if you're going to do a phishing exercise or scenario, right, and maybe this month you do it on a Monday and next month you do it on a Friday, you really can't compare the results because there's a significant difference. And the other was that the time of day matters too. So local time for the person or the victim, recipient, what have you, from I think you said 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., so kind of that lunchtime, is far more effective. People are way more likely to click on the link in that time frame than any other time of the day. So if you send your phishing emails out during the night, it's going to be less effective than if it arrives, you know, at noon.
Interesting. Now, did he have any sort of reason as to why that is?
Well, not a lot. He didn't really, I don't think he really got into the psychology behind it, other than to say his thinking was it was related to just people being more casual at lunchtime and on Fridays.
Interesting. Well, you know, it makes some sense. So what are you going to do about it? I mean, that's an interesting question, right? You know, is that something that user awareness training can combat? Is it something that, you know, that's when your team has to be, you know, more heightened in their monitoring of what's going on? I mean, it's good to know these things, but how do we react to it?
So there were two ideas, and kind of half of this was from Andy Ellis's talk, and the other half was from this specific talk on phishing, was that it is a good idea to perform these phishing exercises, right? But not as a yardstick to determine, hey, you know, how susceptible are we to phishing, but more as a, you know, to get it out there. So what you want to do is, you know, come up with this phishing strategy, or you're going to phish your employees, but tell them you're going to do it. And the point is, get them thinking about actively looking and evaluating whether you know, whether what they're seeing is a phishing email, because they should now know that you're going to be phishing them.
And how long is that valid for? In other words, great, you do training, you have awareness. How quickly does that decay in most people's minds? 30 days, 60 days, 90 days?
Well, I think their point was that you continually do it. So you're You're just continually fishing.
Interesting.
You don't know when it's going to be. It could be whenever. The other thing, and this didn't come up in the in this conference, but I had talked about this with another friend. Something that their company had done was that they actually give away an iPad, and I think they do it once a quarter. And the first person to come back and report a phishing email that was sent out, obviously the one that came from the company, gets put into a lottery, and then once a quarter they have a drawing.
That's clever.
Yeah. The whole point is to get people to actively want to evaluate whether an email is malicious or not.
Did he talk at all about that's kind of the carrot approach? What about anything from a stick approach?
Andy talked a little bit about that, and it was this is a talk worth watching. It's about 50 minutes long, and basically the net of it was he didn't see the stick being terribly effective.
Interesting. So what about other cool talks? I know we're kind of running a little short on time here. Any other kind of takeaways?
There were a couple of others. Josh Corman, who I think, he gave a really interesting talk. I didn't really know what to expect. And it was talk that the talk's name was, I think, We Are the Calvary. And his talk was basically the world of IT is going crazy. The internet of everything is here, and holy cow, is it scary. We as a society are becoming extremely dependent on technology that we're really bad at securing. And it seems like it's kind of going off a cliff. And as an industry, we've got to do something to right the ship. Otherwise, it's just going to get really bad. So that was interesting, although a little depressing, but he did have, there were some follow-ups and some ideas to come out of that. Another one was a talk, and it was actually one of the keynotes given by a guy named Ed Skotis, who's a big SANS instructor. And he, I think his talk was called Kinetic Pwnage. And it was talking about the coming crossover between the cyber world and the physical world, and in particular he was contracted to create this cyber city for the military, and it was outfitted with control systems, and they basically had run these red team blue team exercises where the terrorists had taken over part of the town, and then they had to take it back, and it was actual control systems. So it was a little miniature mock-up, but these control systems, full-size control systems, controlled little street lights, and they had a rocket launcher, which was a Nerf dart gun, and it was pretty neat. So that was really good.
That's cool.
The other one, I mean, there were just a whole bunch of great talks. Mark Baggett gave a talk about Windows being owned by default. That's a really good talk. Every time he talks, it's really good. I recommend going to see that one. The other thing, and this wasn't a talk, I got to talk to a lawyer while I was there, and this is I don't recall the lady's name, and she probably doesn't.
Were
want me
you
to tell
arrested
her.
Again?
I was not. Not this time. All right. And we were talking about two-factor. And especially the fingerprint reader on the iPhone. And, hey, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And the one thing she said, and stick with me, was, here's why you don't want to give up passwords. If your phone is seized, there is no protection. There's no Fifth Amendment protection of you. To where they can't use your fingerprint to unlock your phone, whereas they can't compel you to give that password up unless you're at a at a border crossing.
Oh, right? So when you say you don't want to give up passwords, you're saying you don't stop using passwords.
Don't stop using passwords, right?
Because they could force you to biometrically unlock your phone, but they can't force you to give up a password.
Exactly.
Interesting. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, I hadn't really considered, you know.
Yeah.
I think the point is it's probably a situation where multi-factor is more appropriate, but it was a really interesting point coming from a lawyer.
But Jerry, you know, if you don't lock your phone for the police, the terrorists win.
That's true.
I mean, if you don't have anything to hide, I mean, it's for the children. All right, are any of these working?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, you can keep trying though.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to post the link to the videos from the conference on the site. There's a whole bunch, and I think there's something like 70 or something. It's a crazy number of videos and really amazing stuff. By the way, the videos are hosted by a guy named Adrian Crenshaw. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he actually records lots of different conferences. And so if you go to his YouTube channel, he's got like dozens and dozens of conference videos.
Interesting. Yeah.
So probably hundreds or thousands of videos. So check it out.
Who needs to be productive at work? Let's watch videos.
That's right. Just like my kids at school. Watch videos all day. Who needs to teach? They can do that at home. They can learn all that crap at home. We show them Disney videos. All right. I'm done. Are you done?
Yeah. Good catching up. Good show. You know, sorry we missed a week, but we're back. And,
we're back.
You know, we kind of filled the Attack of the Week slot with DerbyCon review. So I think the ultimate was thumbs up in DerbyCon.
Yes.
And
go next year. Go. Anybody listening, if you're in that part of the world.
Where is it? Can be. When is it?
It is in Louisville, Kentucky. I don't know that they've set the date for next year. It will probably be at the end of September again, as it has been the last 3 years. Usually they open up tickets around the March timeframe. And I recommend you, if you're going to go, buy your tickets then and book your hotel then, because it fills up fast. It's again, not a huge conference. So they'll sell out.
Is it like ShmooCon, which sells out in literally 3 seconds?
No. I think it'll at least last a couple of years. I think it's taken a month or so.
Okay. Not too bad.
No.
Cool.
No.
Excellent. Talk.
All right. Thank you much.
Thanks, Jerry. Have a great week, everybody.
Take care. And, you know, normal closing. You can find the show on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find me on Twitter at MaliciousLink. You can find Mr. Callett on Twitter at Lurg. And by the way, I know last time we did some teasers, you know, Andy got to hang out with some Air Force guys and take some pictures.
Oh, no. Navy.
Oh, dang. Sorry.
Yeah, no, sorry. I forgot about that. Yeah, I got a chance to go down to spend some time at the Blue Angels headquarters in Naval Air Station Pensacola and with a journalist friend of mine who was doing some stories, and I was shooting stills. I do some aviation photography on the side. So I got to meet and talk with maintenance crews and pilots and shoot the two solos going up to do some proficiency flying, because the Blue Angels are grounded this year due to sequester, and it was a really cool trip. So I was hanging out down there at the Naval Air Station.
Sorry.
With the Blue Angels, who are the Navy demonstration team.
Go, you know, Navy. When I edit out me saying Air Force, you're going to sound awful dumb.
Wow, that's not fair. Fair enough. And if you're interested, all those pictures, at least the ones that are publishable, are up on my Flickr account, which you can find off of my Twitter account, Lerg, L-E-R-G, and feel free to go browsers. If you're into military photography and aviation, there's a lot of aviation-related pics out there that you may enjoy.
Yeah, and they're very good, by the way.
Oh, so thank you.
I'll give you a plug there. And, you know, again, if you have any comments, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org, or you can hit us up on Twitter @defensivesec. And with that, I bid you adieu. We'll talk again. It won't be so long next time. Take care. Bye.